It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Money for Lunch. Good to have you here. I'm always excited to, bring you tips, strategies, ideas to make your business and your life better. Today's show is no exception. Let me adjust the mic here. I want to wish Amy, who's my producer, and she's out today, so dealing with some family stuff, so want to wish her the best of luck. Anyway, I don't know about you guys, but man, I'm excited for this week. A lot of good stuff happening this week. And so let's just, let's just dive into today's show with my first guest, Pat Peason. Let's see, where are we at? Oh, here we go. Thank you. Patrick Peason, president of Peason Financial Group. He has been in the financial industry for over 25 years and specializes in the unique challenges that face today's retirees and pre-retirees. Pat focuses on serving the needs of retirees and pre-retirees. He offers conservative strategies that seek to minimize risk to principal while maximizing income. Patrick Peason, welcome to Money for Lunch.
My pleasure to be here, Bert.
All right, so you know what? Before we dive into the meat of our conversation, I wanted to ask you real quick. You know, we've had a fairly decent amount of growth here for a while there. I mean, we had that recession, correction, depression in 2007. Here we are coming up on 2017. Do you think it's time for a little correction or a big correction? Or what is your take on the outlook of the market? Do you think it's still going to be growing at the same pace, backing off?
Well, we had a six-year dramatic run from the bottom of the market after the recession hit, when the market dropped 60%, which bottomed out in March of 2009. And from there until actually when they stopped the quantitative easing, which is November of 2014, the market tripled in value. It literally went up, almost 300%. Since then, we've been sort of, flat. It hasn't grown much. We had a flat year last year. It's about 4.5% this year without the stimulus. So things are a lot different now that we stopped printing money, $80 billion of bond buying with zero interest for all those years. And I think what's happening now is that, well, if you look at historical trends in the market, that we are really, really due for a third major drop in this cycle. We had the drop in 2000 when the tech bubble burst. We had the drop in 2008 with the financial, with the subprime mortgage crisis. And I believe we have a third bubble here, Bert, what I would call the QE bubble, the quantitative easing bubble, that has been sort of suspended in midair for a while because a lot of the things happening across the borders in Europe, in Japan, the U.S. seems like the cleanest dirty shirt in the hamper, but the valuations are extremely high. The leverage that we're trading at is extremely high. So conventional wisdom tells us that I think that we're in for a major correction.
Yeah, and I think that you're not alone. I mean, I've kind of noticed that, and you're right about the we call it the price for some of these stocks are again out of balance, as we saw multiple times. We see this, right? It's a cyclical thing. They get to this point where they become ridiculous, and it's time to buy. And I'm sorry, time to not buy. And maybe look at some other different or look at different strategies. Right now, this is what I'm doing is I'm and this is so funny to say this. I'm waiting for everything to crash so I can buy stuff.
Well, that's the secret of market investing 101, right? Buy low, sell high. So, you know, you're not, I mean, that's not a bad theory to have there, you know, to kind of wait this out a little bit and wait for the correction to come and the prices to straighten out, which mathematically they have to do. It's just a matter of time. And then you buy at a more intelligent time when the ratios are more suitable.
All right, well, let's get into this because, you know, I am one of those pre-retirees. I'm definitely looking at what's happening or what I'm looking ahead at our future. I want to be able to travel with my lovely wife. And as I keep telling my kids, don't expect any inheritance from us. I want to spend every penny I can. So my understanding.
You're like one of my clients.
Go ahead.
Like one of my clients I spoke to the other day. He said he wants his last check to made out to his own. He made out to his undertaker, and it bounces. So that's the perfect retirement plan for somebody like you, Bert.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm a little greedier than that. I've explained to my kids that I'm not going to leave any money, even for the burial. They're going to have to come up with that, and I'm okay with a pine box and, you know, any public. You know, what do you call it, domain space available, just, you know, wherever. If I'm dead, I'm dead. Anyway, but I wanted to ask you this because my understanding and some studies have shown that retirees need around 70% of their working income to thrive during retirement. And some people, yeah, I would probably put myself in this category. I would think that 70% is a positive outlook. I think you need closer to 100%, but I want to get your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Bert. And as you said in the introduction, we work exclusively with retirees and pre-retirees in our planning firm. And it's interesting. So we try to coordinate a retirement plan for people that are within 5 years or 5 to 7 years of retirement, so they can sort of have peace of mind of knowing that they will have enough income to have the lifestyle they've been used to living during retirement. So you have to kind of think intelligently. Let's say the average person retires at age 65. Well, if you made age 65, life expectancy takes you into your high 80s. So that's 23 years on average that you're going to live. And I don't think anybody deserves to take a lesser lifestyle in retirement. If anything, I find my clients want to travel more. They have more time on their hands, especially early in retirement, and they want to, you know, want to do more things perhaps. So what the smart thing to do, or what we try to help people do, is figure out their Social Security, figure out any pensions they may have in retirement, and then simply do the top-down approach where, let's say, you know, you're making, just to name a figure, $60,000 in as you're working. And maybe your expenses, when you talk about your FICA tax, your Medicare, and your Social Security, might be about $6,000 or $7,000 that you're paying into that you won't have in retirement. And maybe you're putting, you know, 10 or 12% in your 401k or retirement plan. Well, those are expenses that you won't have in retirement, so we deduct that from the salary you're used to and figure out exactly what you're living on now. Maybe that's $45,000, just to have a hypothetical example. So that's the type of income you need to generate in retirement to keep the lifestyle you're used to living. So we try to take the expenses that you won't have in retirement that you have while you're working and come up with that figure as a minimum. Now we have to factor in inflation. You know, the inflation rate is very, very low right now, but it's funny, Bert, my clients, my retired clients especially, tell me they feel the effects much more than the so-called 1.5 inflation rate we're building at, because they don't put into the CPI index costs for fuel, costs for food, costs for health care, and these are often the expenses that retirees feel the most. So you have to, you know, you really have to put that into perspective, because if we take the average inflation rate of 3% and factor it in over 20 years, you're going to need more than two times the amount of money 20 years from now that you are today to have that same lifestyle. So I agree with you totally. 70%. Maybe statistically, that sounds like a good number, but in the real world, in the practical world, the retirees and pre-retirees I talk to every day, no, they need at least as much and 5, 10, 15 years out even more. So that's the reality of it. Especially the people that have been in retirement a long time, they realize that if anything, they need a little more money because things go up.
Sure, absolutely. And you know what? Look, let's just say that everything stays the same. Okay, forget about inflation and taxation. Just throw that aside for a second. I think that what people need to consider, here are the biggest expenses that we're going to run into. Let's say that you retire around the age of 65 or 70. What I have noticed is that between 70 and 90, you have a plethora of medical bills that will suck mm-hmm. up a bunch of your money. I mean, my father is 93, 94 years old. And
good for you.
Yeah, and my grandfather was 104 when he passed away. And so my point being
wow.
is that, you know, it was very uncommon, Pat, for somebody to live to, you know, 95 or 100. That was so uncommon just, you know, 25, 30 years ago. Now we're seeing those numbers on a regular basis. So hitting 80 is almost a guarantee, 85 almost a guarantee. And then there's medical bills that go with that. And sometimes even with Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance, you still may, you know, have a massive out-of-pocket expense that, you know, that happens as the body starts to fall apart.
Well, the first question I want to ask you, Bert, is what is your family? What is the, what type of food do they eat? What type of lifestyle do they have to live that long? That's pretty impressive.
Well, you know what? Let me tell you.
I want to get on that diet.
What's interesting? Yeah. Well, and let me tell you what's interesting about that is that my grandfather was a good old ranch type person, right? He had a working ranch, and he worked up until he passed away. He was on a horse, and he would do stuff on his ranch. Now, my father, on the other hand, smokes, drinks, eats tons of red meat, and he's outlived all his friends. So
wow.
I think the answer to that is just you know, good genetics, and I'm hoping that I'm hoping I've caught some of those genetics. I'd like to live you know, just as long of a time. But you know, anyway. So
well, at least he doesn't gamble, right?
He doesn't gamble, right? And you know, I used to tease him and say he used to chase wild women, but, you know, until he caught one.
You know what I'm doing there. Oh, there you go. Maybe that's the secret. Yeah, but think about it, Bert. You're absolutely right.
You know what? Now, I was going to say maybe his secret is that, you know, he's on his fourth wife, so maybe that could have something to do with it. I don't know.
Wow. Now, that is very impressive. That may be the secret to long life.
That's
But
multiple wives.
And as you say, you know, I'm 56 years old and so-called pre-retiree, I guess. And think about it. When we work, if we work 40, 50 hours a week, we're not spending a lot of money typically during the week, especially if our children are grown and out of college and those bills are out of the way. You know, maybe we're at the dinner once or twice a week. The travel, yeah, we can take a couple weeks a year maybe. But when we retire, don't we deserve to have the lifestyle that we work so hard for if we're able to do it? And
yes,
if anything, with more time on our hands, there's more time and more opportunities to spend money and travel and see the world and, you know, hopefully do some things you want to do. So I think, you know, a fair estimate is to make sure you at least have as much money in retirement as you had when you were working. Salary minus the deductions, you know, that you're investing or, you know, coming out for taxes and that sort of thing. And so I don't believe in the 70%. I agree with you 100% that we need at least 100% to plan for a reasonable and comfortable retirement, because the biggest fear people have today in my office is not fear of death so much, but fear of running out of money before they run out of life. And I think the major reason that happens in all my years in this business and working with retirees, Bert, is that a lot of times people do not have a specific plan, a reliable, consistent plan for taking income. in retirement, and they kind of haphazardly draw money out of certain buckets, thinking I could take a little here, a little there, and then before you know it, you know, a drop in the market or a correction happens, and it could be put them in a position where all of a sudden their income goes way down, not up, but down, you know, at a time in life they can ill afford to have that happen.
Right. Absolutely correct. Let me ask you this. Let's talk about what are some of the things that we can do? What are some of the best strategies we can use to maximize our ability to have our money last?
Well, once we get to retirement and we do stop working, we have that nest egg from our 401k or retirement plan, hopefully, if we're fortunate enough or if we have a pension. But most people, a lot of people, you know, took advantage of, you know, the somewhat forced savings plans in the 80s and 90s and, of course, up until today in our IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, where, you know, you can't take it out until 59 and a half without a big penalty. So it was good incentive to be used for retirement monies. So once we get to that point, most people take their 401k and their 403b and their 457 and roll it over into an IRA. And it gives you a couple of advantages, several advantages, but the main two are inside an IRA. Now you have control of the plan. You're not limited to the options inside the 401 or 403b. And secondly, it's also tax efficient for your heirs. But once you have it, and the biggest mistake I see is that a lot of times retirees and advisors guiding retirees haven't made the paradigm shift from strategies, investment strategies that are designed for growth in the long time frame they have of over a 30 or 40 year working career where they can ride the ups and downs and highs and lows and in the long run get the market gains. They haven't made the shift from those strategies into specific distribution strategies that are designed to take your income from interest and dividends. And if there's one thing I really would like to leave your audience with for people that are like you and I that are pre-retirees or in retirement is the one principle to take your income when you're retired out of these accounts from interest and dividends. Because if you start to sell principal and hope and pray that the market cooperates, it could be devastating. I've seen a lot of people, you know, ruin their retirements, quite frankly, by not making that paradigm shift. And I think a lot of advisors I see, you know, by keeping people in mutual funds and in the stock market throughout retirement, which is, you know, kind of an easy way to do it, just being in the same strategies, haven't educated a lot of people about making that shift, that when you get to retirement, you can have peace of mind by making sure that you're in strategies that generate interest and dividends because they are the guarantees you can count on for income and retirement.
I love that. I love that because if you can pay your bills, if you can have the lifestyle you want based on your dividends and your interest income, then you're good to go forever.
Exactly. And it gives a lot of peace of mind of knowing that you're taking the income from the egg and not the chicken.
Yep, I love it. I love it. Hey, Pat, we're out of time. Love to bring you back and talk more about financial strategies. Patrick Peason, thank you so much for stopping by today.
My pleasure, Bert. Enjoyed it very much. Look forward to our next time.
All righty. Good stuff there about you and your money, your retirement. And, it's that mind shift, right? We got to make money for us. Or better yet, make our money that makes money for us make us money. So any way we can do that is always the best way. We're going to take a quick commercial break, speaking of money, and make some money so we can pay some bills. And then we'll be back right after.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest, Sean Hunter. Sean Hunter is the president and founder of Mind Scaling, a company building online learning courses based on the work of best-selling authors. His new book is Small Acts of Leadership, 12 Intentional Behaviors That Lead to Big Impact. And you can find out more about Sean at seanhunter.com. Sean Hunter, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, thanks so much, Bert. Psyched to be here.
You know, what's interesting is in many of the seminars and speaking engagements that I have done over the decades, one of the things I have taught the audience is that you can take your favorite book and turn it into a course. And, you know, you're not, you know, it's just a great, you know, it's a great way of, if you don't know what you want to do, if you don't have a product that you can digitize, then grab your favorite book on leadership, on health, on you know, money, and you could do a little course on it or whatever. And I love this idea of mind scaling that you've come up with.
Yeah, totally. We're pretty psyched about this company. So Mind Scaling is a company in which we work with mostly business best-selling authors. So they might be writing on communication, collaboration, teamwork, leadership, innovation, growth mindset, all kinds of different topics that accelerate businesses, make businesses better at what they do. And so we work with these really, you know, gurus and thought leaders and best-selling authors, and we convert their body of work. Sometimes it's a specific book or sometimes it's a series of books, and we'll turn it into a course, like a rich media course, assessment, interactivity, rich media, video, actionable items, you know, stuff they can use with their teams. And the funny thing is a lot of times we're working with these authors and they'll say, oh, well, this course needs to be 6 hours or 8 hours or you know, 3 months. And we'll say, no, we're trying to make a point here in just like half an hour, 40 minutes, you know, something tight, something sharp that grabs people's attention.
Yes, you know what, and I could see them saying, hey, my body of work is super important and it needs 10, 15, 20 hours. Yes, it might be, but unfortunately the human mind can only stand what the butt can endure. And most attention spans nowadays probably wouldn't sit still for 10 or 12 hours.
That's exactly right. I mean, in the world that I'm in of learning and online learning and business development, human capital development, there's a catchphrase now called micro-learning that you may have heard of. And it's basically the concept of people don't have a lot of time and we need to cut it down into little slivers, little like 60-second, 90-second brain snacks for people. And that's true to a point, but we believe at Mind Scaling that while we do construct these courses using micro-learning techniques, those micro-learning chunks are set in the context of a greater curriculum to drive change over time. It's kind of like P90X, you know. If the guy on the DVD says, what's his name, Sean T says you got to do your crunches now, well, the crunches are all in the pursuit of the beach body, which is going to take, you know, a few months to get to.
Absolutely, absolutely. And because Tony Horton is a friend of mine, I'm going to throw this out there. The P90X is Tony Horton. And then the Sean T does he does a couple of different ones. He does the now I can't forget them. I can't remember something. But they're like one's like a back to your micro learning.
Insanity.
He's come out with
insanity.
A new one of insanity. Yeah, insanity. Yeah, man. So, but you know what? I want to dive into your book, Small Acts of Leadership. And my first question to you is this. Before we get into the subject matter, give me your definition of leadership.
That's a good question. And I think people often confuse managing and leading. So historically, management and being a manager was to manage things and to count things. So you count how many hours or how many products or how many inputs or how many outputs, and you're responsible for the management of, you know, a facility or a business or a service or something. And there's a lot of noise these days that management is becoming obsolete. You know, we don't need managers anymore. And I disagree, and the reason I disagree is because management is not leadership. Leadership is the ability to lift people up, to embolden their dreams, to amplify their capabilities, to inspire others, and that requires sometimes letting people take risks, sometimes letting people experiment and fail, but always having their back. And so you might say, well, managers are the lifeblood of an organization, but I believe that really leaders are. And because you'll never say to yourself, oh, I work for company XYZ, and I really love the company. I hate my boss. You know, I can't stand my boss, but I love the company. Your interpretation of how you feel about your job and your work and your company, you see through the lens, through the vision of the person that you work for. And if they're a leader, they're going to uplift you, and they're going to make you feel really energized about going to work with a sense of purpose.
I love that. I love that definition because, you know what, to me, based on your definition, we can all be leaders, because if our job as a leader is to inspire, to nurture, to encourage, to uplift others, then, you know, mom, dads are leaders, brothers, sisters can be leaders, school teachers can be leaders, not just managers, not just CEOs, but anybody who is uplifting, making you feel good, making you, we call it encouraging you and lifting you up is a leader.
Yeah, amen. I mean, I totally believe that. The opening story in my book is about the great John Wooden, you know, the great UCLA basketball coach from the 60s and 70s. And he was just an iconic figure in leadership. So people think, well, what he must have done, the way he coached, is unachievable. I'll never get there. There's no way that I could become the great John Wooden. Well, actually, he did it little steps at a time, small acts, little words that he said. Once some students at UCLA followed him around for a year to figure out what makes him tick. You know, how does he do what he does? How does he get 30-0 back-to-back undefeated seasons? Mm-hmm. Turns out this guy spoke on average for about 4 seconds at a time. He never gave big locker room speeches. He never gave big speeches in the huddle from the sidelines. And at the first day of practice, the very first day of practice, if you played on his team, he would teach you how to properly put on your socks and shoes.
Oh, man. Talk about becoming brilliant at the basics. Now we're going to start with our socks, and now we're going to go with our shoes, and this is how you lace them. But you know what? A lot of things that help us become great, you know, to use your vernacular, are these small acts, right? It's not these big things. It's these small acts that we do consistently. And in your book, Small Acts of Leadership, 12 Intentional Behaviors That Lead to Big Impact, I want to talk about some of these small acts these 12 small acts. So let's talk about, out of the 12 intentional behaviors, which one do you find is like the one?
Well, there's a lot of them I like. I mean, as you can imagine.
There's at least 12, right?
yeah. But I'll pick one that I particularly like, and it's this idea of overcoming fears and overcoming big, sometimes irrational fears that we have, that we feel like are unrelated to anything else in our life. They're just fears that we carry around. So if you think of the top fears out there, it's heights, afraid of heights. That's always in the top three. Things like spiders and almost always snakes. Like snakes is in the top one, two, three every year of what people are terrified of. Well, there's a guy at Stanford named Albert Bandura. He's a psychologist. And what he did was he started experimenting with trying to eradicate phobias, the fear of particularly snakes, in people. And so through this series of guided mastery, I won't go into the whole detail, but over sequential visits to his office and witnessing and watching snake handlers and then finally, you know, actually having a snake in their lap, over weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, he would totally get rid of their fear of snakes. That's great. Okay, great. Then here's the interesting part. He'd follow up with them by phone. He'd check in with them every few weeks or a month later. They'd call him up, you know, 6 months later, call him. How's it going? You still got rid of the snake thing? Yep. Yeah, I got rid of it. One woman said she had a dream that a boa constrictor was helping her to wash the dishes. And that's when she knew she was really cured of her phobia. But here's what I want to get to. What he discovered is when these people take care of one big, scary fear in their life, other areas of in their life start to open up. Like this one guy, he was a real estate agent, and he couldn't deal with the rural properties. You know, you can't show farmhouses and stuff. Who knows? It might be snakes. So he started taking on the suburban rural properties and being more bold, taking more risks at work and more chances. And another woman started taking ballroom dancing. Another guy tried skydiving. Someone else started horseback riding. The point is that when you take one big nasty fear in your life and you can eradicate it, it will slowly embolden you to open up other areas of your life that you never even thought of, you never even thought existed.
Yeah, you know what, and it's funny when you talk about that, it makes total sense, right? If you overcome this one fear, then you gain some confidence, you're able to, maybe make that jump. If I can get over my fear of snakes, then maybe writing a book isn't that bad. Or if I can get rid of my fear of heights, then maybe I can overcome my fear of snakes or whatever the deal is. Let me ask you this, because in the book, you write that skills and intelligence, while desirable traits, are not enough to enable team members to perform at peak levels. Let's talk about this. Why is it necessary for leaders to engage with them, with their teams on different levels?
Yeah, so I'll pick this one interview that I did for the book. So I interviewed a lot of business leaders and entrepreneurs and MBA faculty, you know, big, brilliant people a lot smarter than I am. And I interviewed this guy named Victor Cho. Victor Cho. Victor Cho is the president and CEO of Evite. So Evite.com is that invitation service you probably use for your kids' birthday parties or the potluck dinner, or, you know, et cetera. And he has a lot of experience in Silicon Valley entrepreneurial startups, and he's had a lot of experience with recruiting and retaining talent. And he puts people's attributes into these kind of three buckets. One, do they have the skills? Do they have the chops? You know, do they have the ability to perform the job? That's one. Two, can they put what he calls points on the board? Points on the board means outcomes. Make sales, write lines of code, make really valuable contributions to the business. That's points on the board. And the third attribute that he looks for is something he calls energy accretion. Energy accretion. Now, energy accretion basically means your ability to kind of be part of an uplifting mood state. The question you would ask yourself is, when somebody has an interaction with me, do they leave with more or less energy? I mean, are you one of these kind of people that people dread to interact
okay,
with?
Okay, say that again.
Energy accretion.
Say that. Go ahead. Yeah, it's energy accretion. Say it again.
Well, the concept is, are you someone who uplifts the people around you, the team? Do you add to the energy dynamic? Are you part of a growth mindset? Are you part of creating a more dynamic and uplifting environment? Or are you like an energy suck? You know, are you an energy vampire?
Gotcha. Right.
And of those three categories.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Of those three categories, he thinks the energy part is the most important because skills can be learned and points on the board take time. But it really comes down to the mood state and how positively team members can influence the entire company.
Sure, and that makes sense because, look, when you think of your favorite people, they're not your favorite people because they look a certain way or smell a certain way or have a specific body type, but they're some of your favorite people because of the way they make you feel.
Amen.
I mean, that's it. And so I totally like that theory of energy accretion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love that idea. Yeah, and I want everybody to kind of focus on this a little bit because how you make people feel is how they remember and whether they're going to help you, whether they like you, whether they're going to stay part of your team. You know, you mentioned something in the beginning of the show was that somebody likes the company but hates their boss. If that isn't remedied, eventually that person quits because we may like the company, but if we can't stand the people that we work with, we eventually leave that company.
That's it. As there's an old adage that says, the boss is the dinner table conversation at the end of the day. You know, because the people that we report to often become the subject of our conversations at the dinner table. And so if you're a boss or a leader out
right.
there, how do you want people to talk about you around the dinner table?
Absolutely. And by the way, back to my comment earlier, this applies to moms and dads and brothers and sisters and, you know, because we are all influencers. We're all leaders. And how we make people feel is really our job. Or let me rephrase that. Making people feel good about themselves is really what our job's all about. Because if people feel good about themselves when they're around you, they automatically like you and they want to do more and they'll work harder for you. So I like this. I like this Mr. Cho's idea there.
Yeah, I think it's dead on. There's another guy that I interviewed for the book. His name is Hap, H-A-P, Hap Klopp. He's the former CEO and founder of the North Face, like the North Face apparel company, tents, jackets, boots, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
He's a very interesting guy. And he told me a story about early on when he first founded the North Face. This is back in the late 60s, actually. And he said, well, they were, you know, a small company in San Francisco. And they're running into a lot of troubles, a lot of financial issues, a lot of supply issues, a lot of manufacturing problems, you know, trying to get going. And he said there were a lot of things that he needed to solve and work on. And some of the kinds of stuff was boring accounting things, spreadsheets and phone calls with vendors. And other things that needed to be done was like rearrange the warehouse and the supply chain of how things moved through the warehouse from their facility to the consumer. And he chose, importantly, he chose to do a lot of the visible work. And by that, I mean, you know, he was rolling up his sleeves and getting his hands dirty, and he was painting walls and moving shelves and stocking boxes and collaborating with people on the floor to ship goods. And he has this expression that I like, which is every action you make is a statement. Your actions are statements. And in fact, they're more powerful than the words you say. So he really believes in kind of rolling up your sleeves and actively participating in the work that needs to be done. Delegation is important. I mean, certainly if you don't have the skills or the chops to do something, or there's somebody's more qualified or specialized in that, delegation is really important as well for efficiency. But the importance of showing up and the recognition that the actions that you undertake are indeed statements to those around you is critically important for leadership.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Sean, we're out of time. I'd love to bring you back and talk more about your best-selling book. The Small Acts of Leadership, 12 Intentional Behaviors That Lead to Big Impact. And you can find it at Amazon or wherever good books are sold. Sean Hunter, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks so much, Bert. Appreciate it.
You bet. Good stuff there from Sean Hunter. And I just love this Small Acts of Leadership, 12 Intentional Behaviors That Lead to Big Impact, right? And I like the phrase intentional. And I don't know, it kind of, makes more sense to me. Anyway, we're going to be right back.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. We are back. And I'm excited to have to talk to my next guest, Steve Mariotti. Steve Mariotti left a successful business career in 1982 to become a public high school teacher in New York City's roughest neighborhoods. Steve discovered he could reach even the most troubled students by teaching them to run small businesses. I love this idea. In 1987, he founded the Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship to bring entrepreneurship education to low-income youth. Steve has just been named the Fellow of Entrepreneur Education for FILU Center of Entrepreneurship at Philadelphia University. Steve Mariotti, welcome to Money for Lunch.
I'm glad to be here, Bert. Thank you.
All right, so I got to ask you this. You know, here you are in your career, and it's one thing to say, listen, I want to change careers. I want to go be a teacher. But it sounds to me like you chose specifically to go to these rougher neighborhoods. Is that right?
Yes. I got mugged in, and I had post-traumatic stress disorder for about 6 months.
Gotcha.
I got therapy, thank God, and with a guy named Albert Ellis, who was famous back in the 80s for working with people with, a neuroses or a post-traumatic stress disorder. And he said, just go teach for a month in really difficult schools, and it'll go away. And he was right. I went in first day. I went into the worst school in New York where they couldn't get any teachers. It was Boys and Girls High School in Stuyvesant. Now it's a really good school. But 30 years ago, it was, terrible. None of the teachers would go there. The minute I walked in, my life changed. I wanted to be a teacher of at-risk kids, and it's really what I've done since 1981, so 35 years, and I've loved it.
Man, that's amazing. I just – it's interesting how things work out, you could have done the natural thing and said, man, I'm not, you know, I just got mugged. I'm not going to go and put myself at risk, which is what essentially a lot of people have already said. They had written off the school. But you said, no, I'm going to go there. I'm going to take my counselor's advice and go there. So kudos to that. And then I want to find out, how did you stumble upon teaching entrepreneurship to these at-risk kids? How did that come about?
Again, it was my therapist's idea. It wasn't something that I had thought of at all. And, you know, I had all the normal reactions of someone who's been, you know, assaulted and robbed and threatened and all that. You know, I was very angry toward, you know, the type of kids that had done that. And so it was a concept called flooding, which a lot's been written about it. When you have a phobia or fear or neuroses, they're using it also with young men that come back with post-traumatic stress disorder, veterans. But if you mm-hmm. can relive the experience in a positive way and change the sentences in your mind that describe it. So I was saying, you know, I'm a, you know, not a very strong young man because I got mugged and beaten up by some 13-year-olds or 14-year-olds, and I was 25, 26. Well, using that, I was able to change the sentence to, I was a hero because I survived. And then I flooded the experience by going into the worst schools in New York City and teaching. I taught for years at Rikers Island, which is the largest jail in the world, actually, and they have 1,000 children there under 17 in a high school. They're incarcerated.
Wow.
And you know, I found that almost all of low-income children or children with a disability, you know, are paralyzed or are terminally ill or have some, you know, great tragedy of illness, that if you can tap into the entrepreneurial part of their brain, they have enormous abilities because they're able to turn that pain and that feeling of rejection and the feeling that they can sell to anybody. And so this idea of entrepreneurship for people that have been disenfranchised, I think it's one of the most important breakthroughs in global education of the last 50 years.
You know, and I think you're dead on as far as these at-risk kids who are struggling because of, you know, a learning defect or whatever, you know, and sometimes it's a home life. But what is it that you think that resonates with them or changes them or, you know, I'm trying to figure out what their correct word is, but what do you think is making this connection with them about running their own business that turns them around?
You know, I think it's two things. One, a lot of people view the world in a hierarchy, and so if you're poor economically in particular, and you don't do well in school, you're not doing well in sports, you don't have a girlfriend, you don't have nice clothes, you view yourself at the bottom of the world with everybody else above you. And it's torture. I think we've all been there at one time or another in our lives. And it's just, you know,
sure,
a terrible feeling. But if you can change the mindset of somebody who feels that they're at the bottom and change it to an entrepreneurial mindset where they're not viewing life as a hierarchy, i.e., he's better than me, she's better than me, they got better SAT scores, this and that and this and that, but rather you view it as a mosaic or a picture, and you view yourself as the middle, not above or below anybody, but as part of a community where you can talk to and sell to any other person. And I think that's the beauty of entrepreneurship is in this concept of starting a business. It can lift people out of this albatross of feeling this weight on top of them, that they're on the bottom, and take them into a different world where every other human being in every situation, every country becomes an opportunity to look for problems to be solved. And there's a lot of research that the happiest people in the world are entrepreneurs, and that in that subset, the happiest people in the world are American women entrepreneurs.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Interesting. Now, you also have a book out, Steve. I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about your book. It's called The Entrepreneur's Manifesto. Is that right?
Yes, The Entrepreneur's Manifesto.
So talk about this a little bit. First of all, what was the inspiration behind writing the book?
Well, I turned 60, and I've been, you know, working as a founder of an organization called the Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship. And I founded that in 1987. It's an incredible organization. It's all over the world now. We have 700,000 graduates. Our new CEO is Sean Osborne, who came out of the very high-level for-profit background. And he's taking us to another level. And we specialize in teaching low-income youth around the world how to start small businesses. Our largest program
and I'm
is
sorry,
China.
The CEO's name is Sean Osborne?
Yeah. Great, great guy. And I founded it in 87 and ran it with other people, you know, for 27 years, and then recently semi-retired. And as I was retiring, you know, to just work on being an educator one day a week and do other things with my life, I realized that I had never, in the 38 books that I had written, which had all been how-to books, how do you start a business in a tough neighborhood with no money? When everything's against you, how do you do that? That's been my specialty. And I've sold 22 million books globally. I'm the top selling author in the world for people under the age of 22. So I'm very proud of that. But I realized...
Absolutely.
Thank you. I'd never written a book that I could pass on to younger generations arguing why they should never let this beautiful concept of entrepreneurship, markets, capitalism go. In other words, don't let it disappear. And it's very easy to do that as governments grow and the tax code that we have here is just horrible, incomprehensible. And I've traveled all over the world. I was in Cambodia and Vietnam recently. And wherever you see people wanting to start businesses and talking about how to solve problems through entrepreneurship and learning about ownership and how to achieve ownership, you see a society that's booming and flourishing in every way, including in the arts. And whenever I go to a city or a country where people are talking differently. They're talking about how do they get more government tax dollars, or how do they force somebody who to do something that they wouldn't normally do. Whenever people are talking about using violence against other people and not a voluntary trade, which is what the entrepreneur does, those societies are depressed, they're low income, the art there is either non-existent or so depressing you can barely, you know, look at it. There's something about a free society of men and women who choose whether or not they want to go into business themselves, choose their own careers, and are open to both success and failure, both of which can be both beautiful things, but can also be very difficult for people. But those societies, in my lifetime, those societies thrive and grow and create wealth and beauty and joy and happiness. And the alternative of societies that are state-owned, a lot of laws, a lot of regulations, horrible high taxes, almost impossible to start a business, those societies shrink and become mean and almost ugly in many ways. So,
sure.
This my latest book. Hopefully, it won't be my last. It took me 2 years to write, and is a direct counter to just about all the literature against a free society. So I went back and I read all the horrible documents, Communist Manifesto, Mein Kampf by Hitler, who was a socialist and a big believer in state control. I read Lenin's works, Khrushchev, Mao. I read all these books that had influenced billions of people over the last 200 years. And I decided that my book would take them all on intellectually and make the case for a free society, free speech, the Bill of Rights, and the right to start, own, and operate a small business. And I think it's a classic book. I think everyone should read it. And again, it's called An Entrepreneur's Manifesto. And my last name is Mariotti, like the hotel, but with an I at the end.
Yep. I love it. I love it. And I'm assuming that the Entrepreneur's Manifesto is available on Amazon.
Absolutely. All my books are available on Amazon. They just go to Amazon and type in Steve Mariotti, M-A-R-I-O-T-T-I. And there are three classics, in my opinion. One is An Entrepreneur's Manifesto. Two is Entrepreneurship, which is the leading textbook in the world for high school students. And the third is Entrepreneurship and Management, which is the leading book in colleges in America for the field of entrepreneurship. So
wow. Hey Steve, we're out of time, but I'd love to bring you back. I'd also like Sean Osborne on the show as well to talk more about the Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship. Steve, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, and I love your story. I'm so grateful that you got mugged because you changed the world.
Thank you. I'll come back anytime, and I'll make sure we get Sean on. Great conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you, Steve. We'll make it happen. Steve Mariotti, everybody. Steve, M-A-R-I-O-T-T-I. You can go to Amazon or wherever your favorite bookstore is and find his books, Entrepreneur Manifesto, plus he's wrote about approximately 20 others. And it just goes to show you, this is a great example where he took something that could have been tragic And the old turn lemon into lemonade story, right? This is a fantastic lemonade story. I love it. I love it. I love it. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at Money. Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.